Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Jorge Giovannetti. He's the author of Black British Migrants in Cuba, Race, Labor, and Empire in the 20th Century Caribbean, 1898 to 1948, published by Cambridge in 2018. This book turns its attention to workers from the British Caribbean islands who were essential to the Cuban sugar industry in the early 20th century. Even as they were deemed absolutely necessary by the owners of that sugar industry, they were often subject to violence and mistreatment. This carefully researched book offers a detailed account of the kinds of obstacles Black British workers faced and the ways they responded to those challenges. Using research from at least a dozen archives, this is a key contribution to histories of Cuba, the British Caribbean, migration, and labor. Hello, Jorge. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
So as we were saying, I really enjoyed your book, and I want to just jump right into talking about it. And maybe we can start out with just you talking a little bit about how you came to the project in the first place.
Okay. The project for the book Black British Migrants in Cuba really emerged out of trying to explore a moment in history in which two subregions of the Caribbean would meet, basically out of Harry Huting's book on the two variants on Caribbean race relations. That was sort of the initial thing that triggered me into, okay, if he speaks about race relations in the Caribbean, in Caribbeans in two different ways, I want to explore a historical moment in which two Caribbeans met. So that's, even though that doesn't come out in the book in its current form, that's sort of what triggered my interest into looking at the experience of British Caribbean migrants in Cuba in a Hispanic Caribbean context.
So actually that explains a little bit, a partial answer to my next question, which is that you call it, I think it's in the introduction, you call it an unbound history. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could tell us what you mean by that.
I guess in a way, it was unbound in the sense that it was, it didn't have frontiers, both in terms of regions and in terms of the subregions of the Caribbean, but also in many ways disciplinarily. So if we take it from Huting's book, which again doesn't come out in the book after, you know, so many years working in the project and many other reasons that motivated me into doing it. So they started with a sociological question, a sociological kind of line of inquiry, and then it moved into a historical, more of a historical research that also nourished itself from anthropological research and ethnography. So there's that aspect of it. And then there is the other element in the history itself, which deals with people moving across boundaries of the Caribbean, across different regions from not only from Jamaica to Cuba, but also from the Eastern Caribbean into Cuba, but as well people that went into Central America and then ended up in Cuba after enterprises like the Panama Canal and banana agribusiness went down. So in that sense, there's that aspect of crossing boundaries. And then sort of finally, I would say that with all the sort of more recent emphasis into transnational history, I guess using the term unbound was a way to sort of frame it into transnational history, but also use another word that sort of expressed my reservations with the term transnational to be more explicit about it. Whereas while I use the term, and I in the sense that I'm dealing with the Cuban nation and the crossing of its boundaries, I was dealing with other territories that were not necessarily nations as such, such as the colonies of the British Empire and the British Empire itself. So in that sense, I had some sort of uneasiness about using the term, sort of something that was unbound also fit into that aspect of the book.
Mm. And by the same token, a project like this really requires a broad range of sources and a broad range of archives, right? If you're going to be talking about all of these different places. So I'm wondering how you navigated all of those archives. How did you pull all of that together?
It was very, very difficult to do it. I don't know. I don't remember how many archives and countries I have there. Probably more than 13 archives in sort of 9 countries. So it was sort of a very challenging task. Sort of in terms of very practical ways of the actual research process, I don't know to what extent we want to get into that. But what I did was sort of the way I worked with all these many archives. And to begin, I knew I had to tackle that. And I knew that if I were not going to do the project like going to all these archives, I would not do it, to the extent that at some points there were some archives I wanted to see. And I said, no, this is not coming out unless I see that collection and I'm sure that I don't miss anything. So there was that obsessive part of me of trying to look for all the archives. But in very practical terms, what I did was that I – for every archive that I did research on, I had a different file in my database and in my computer that would become a document for that archive chronologically organized. So at the end of the day, I have a file for each archive, and that file that is in the database but also in a Word document is chronologically organized. That's a way to, I guess, for instance, if I wanted to look at what was happening in 1917, for instance, the massacre in Hobab of the British West Indians, then I would know what was documented about that event in the different archives for that year. So that was a way, a very practical way to organize it. A colleague of mine told me, asked me about it. Oh, do you still have those bound bound folders with all your archives? I said, yes, I do have them. So that was a way to sort of to make all that data, all that information manageable. Otherwise, I would, I don't know how I would have managed, but certainly there's the Public Records Office, now called the National Archives, local archives, such as Spanish Town in Jamaica, the Archivo Nacional de Cuba, National Archive in Cuba, but also a lot of provincial archives, and as well as company papers, such as United Fruit Company papers in Cuba or the Cuba Company papers in Maryland, in McKelding Library. So it was sort of organized by archive and chronologically that was the better way to do it.
Ah, I see. So and at the same time, I mean, you have this very broad reach. You really sort of, as you say, traveled all across the Caribbean and you're able to put things together in that way. But I noticed also that the book gets very close and it gets to individuals and it gets to stories of people, right? And I noticed that one of the things that you did was you used the Erna Brodbur interviews. And I was really happy to see somebody yeah. using those interviews, because they've always struck me as being so rich and so full of potential.
Yeah.
How did you find them?
I guess I knew about them because my first book was in Jamaica, and I was on reggae music on Jamaica. So in many ways, I was familiar with the Jamaican and British West Indian scholarship, Anglophone Caribbean historiography and social sciences. So I knew they existed. I didn't know that they were so rich until I, went there to see them. So I knew it. So it was just a matter of going there, finding the way to get into Jamaica to look at that specific source, and that's what I did. It's an excellent source, as you know, in terms of its quality, the details it has, and I guess, Caribbean scholars should be forever grateful to Erna Brodbear for doing that work. And it's something that, really should be recognized, that it was not only for her own scholarship and the two books that have come out of it, but also it has helped the work of people like me, Lara Putnam, Julie Green, and others. But that was the way I did it. I just knew that the source existed, and I would then sort of look for the way to go to those sources and see them. That applies to other collections I used that I knew existed. Let's say the Carl Withers collection that I'm using now, but that I also use for the book. I knew it existed, so it was just a matter of getting there to see the collection. Or also, the William Gonzalez papers. Gonzalez was the ambassador to Cuba, U.S. ambassador to Cuba during the massacre in Jobabo. So I knew they were in South Carolina. So it was just a matter of, getting to South Carolina and see the papers. So that was the way it happened with the Brodbear materials on Jamaica.
Was there anything that you really wanted to find at some point and you just couldn't get to, or some kind of source that you really wanted but that just didn't exist?
I exploited as much as I wanted. I would have loved to be able to do more interviews to surviving individuals that made the journey, that made the migration. I did had a lot of conversation with many of them while I lived in Cuba, but didn't do that many interviews as I would have liked to do. I mean, probably that would have turned the project unmanageable. But that's probably something that I probably would have loved to do more. Other people have done it, like Audrey Charlton, Andrea Quilly, and Charo Marshall in Barbados. But I guess now that I mentioned the William Gonzalez papers, that was one source that I was that I didn't want to miss. That I wanted to, particularly with dealing with that episode of violence, I really wanted to see what he had. It didn't have as much as I wanted in terms of sort of proving, as a historian, you're sort of trying to prove your argument beyond the doubt, and there was not that much, but there was enough to sort of combine it with other sources and make an argument as to the involvement of Mario Garcia Menocal in the violence that ensued during the Chambellona revolt in 1917.
So a lot of the book is framed through this idea of racial fear that you argue kind of prevailed just as British West Indians were arriving.
Yeah.
And I was wondering about that because a lot of Cuban history and sort of historiography, including even some of the things that I've written, has been defined as intention between racism and anti-racism. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you can talk about where on the spectrum within this tension of racism and anti-racism does your idea of racial fear fall? How does it work with that?
Well, in many ways, I think that that idea sort of emerged out of the scholarship. There's an element of it that is not I guess that is not in a book, and it's probably, you know, I'm trying to make a separate piece, because in order to make the argument about racial fear, I had to sort of go back to the 19th century, which is not covered in the book as, you know, thoroughly and systematically, but it only sort of, as a good historian, I sort of wanted to have the 19th century first in order to speak properly about the 20th century. So the idea sort of comes from there, and I wanted to be sure of how to sort of give proper evidence of how that fear manifested itself, rather than just saying there was racial fear and that was it, without giving evidence of how that fear manifested. So there was that element there. But in terms of how it fit between the debate of racism and anti-racism, it was certainly something that sort of, in a way, guaranteed that such a strong racism or anti-Black racism would persist in Cuba, even despite all the efforts and struggles for racial equality, all the advances of people of African descent in terms of organizations and militancy, and even getting into political life. But there was, I think that the element of racial fear, in a way, sort of guarantees, in a sad way, it guarantees that there will be, you know, this very strong racism and this very strong fear against the black people, and particularly black men as well. So I guess that would be a way in which, or sort of one element that would guarantee sort of if you sort of want to speak about the racism and anti-racism debate as a scale, so that would put the scale more into the sort of persistence and endurance of racism, even to this day in Cuba, even with all the successes, both in the early 20th century with the 1940 constitution and the struggles for racial equality, but also later in the 20th century and early in the 21st century. I mean, there are moments still that I have documented while I was doing my research where, you know, that fear of the black criminal sort of comes out very clearly. So I guess that would be a way. I don't know if that sort of answers your question in terms of that debate.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things that's clear is, or that makes your argument clear, is the way that you track a lot of the violence against Jamaicans, and you argue that it was specifically directed at them. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the nature of that violence.
Yeah, I guess in many ways it was, and I guess to go back to the whole issue of the argument, one was, and the sort of racial fear, and where people in that debate, like Alejandro de la Fuente, Aline Helk, and others sort of located themselves. I think that the fact that I guess the book proves, in a way, both for 1912 and 1917, that even when all those efforts by people of African descent were there, ultimately that violence took place against black people, and that violence was very much anchored in that fear. So that's that also. I think that was sort of something that I really wanted to put there. You know, ultimately, sort of violence would take place depending on the context. In terms of the violence against British Antillians, Caribbean migrants in particular, both you know, Jamaicans and British West Indians in general, but also Haitians, it manifested itself in many ways, from the harassment by the Royal Guards, that were the sort of guards for the government in rural Cuba, government military officials, but also private security guards from the sugar companies in company towns like the Cuban-American sugar company Chaparra and Delicias. They had their own private security guard called the Guardas Jurados. And they would also be hostile and aggressive to the British Antillians, either by hitting them, by stealing their money that they were planned to send away for as remittances. And then there are those moments of economic or political tension, whether that is 1921 with the the fall of the markets, or the 1930s, or the same with the different revolts, in which black people became the target. If something was wrong, that was the black migrants became the scapegoat. Whether if it was an economic depression, it was because they were seen as stealing the jobs of Cubans. But also as the ones that would bring illnesses and diseases, which was another level of discourse against the migrants. So in many ways, they became the guilty ones and someone to blame and against whom white Cubans or security guards very easily, put the blame on and became aggressive to. To give you an example, which is in the book, during the Chambellona revolt, black people became the very explicit target, to the extent that when they were surrendering themselves to the Cuban military, the reason for surrendering, and this is from the archives in Camagüey, that they wrote down in a specific document of surrendering, of presentaciones in Spanish, basically specified, we are surrendering because they are killing the blacks. So that was repeated in many of the surrendering documents, showing that blacks became sort of targets in a very, very direct way, an empirical way, in the sense that it was proven. So there was a big scope of ways in which that violence manifested itself sort of very, very drastically, from actual murdering to abuses, or just plain disregard of their needs as workers or as migrants.
And yet, this is one of the things that makes this book so interesting, is that almost everyone was interested in getting more West Indians to Cuba. Right, at least from an official perspective, the British, the Cubans, the Americans, they all coincided on that front.
Yeah. I mean, there was that moment which it was a necessary evil for the Cubans if they wanted to produce sugar. Of course, U.S. interests were, they needed that labor as well as a Haitian labor, Haitian migrants as well, which became an important part, and at different junctures, even the British, because they were the second largest consumer of Cuban sugar, and particularly that becomes very, very important during the global conflicts, the First World War and the Second World War. In many ways, it went against Cuban interests, and so there is that contradiction whereby you would find many politicians and intellectuals and sort of letters in the press expressing their discomfort, their racism, their discrimination against the black migrant, whether that's from the British Caribbean or the Haitians, but also at the same time sort of admitting that they needed them. And that even happens with the Cuban labor, the working class, the Cuban working class. So that contradiction is there. Of course, it crystallizes during moments of economic crisis. So like in 1921 or the 1930s, that becomes, very obvious. It's like they can't deport them because of the economic situation. So that element, certainly that contradictory element was there, which I guess is something that happens in many societies that receive migrants nowadays, whether we speak about Haitians in the Dominican Republic, Dominicans in Puerto Rico, or Mexicans in the U.S. So that's something that is there.
The book also works from the perspective of these Black migrants, right? And one of the things you talk about is Garveyism. And I was interested in that because it's been understood as less important in Cuba than you argue it was.
Yeah. I mean, Garveyism, I think many people have been writing about in Cuba. I mean, Cuba was the country with most branches of the UNIA, of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, after the United States. So it was a really a stronghold of the movement, and it was very, very important for Garvey, to the sense that Garvey visited the place, but also other leaders like George Alexander Maguire and visited also Cuba. So it was very, very important for the Garvey movement in terms of its international reach and hemispheric reach, and also particularly in the region. The one detail about it, which was fascinating to me, is that it didn't necessarily operate it fully as a Black organization strictly as a Black organization or as an organization for the African diaspora under that rubric, but also it operated as a religion in a way. So that religious element of the Garvey movement sort of crystallized in a very strong way in Cuba, if one reads the documents and the materials that come out of it. For instance, the services that get reported in the Negro World, the newspaper. Also the fact that George Alexander Maguire visited Cuba in 1921 as well as Garvey in a separate trip. And he was, in my analysis, I think he was sort of received with the communities in a very strong way, in a very sort of so was very well received. So that element is there. One of the reasons, of course, is that probably was behind this was the fact that after 1912 and after the Morua law and the prohibition of organizations that were explicitly racial, as the Partido Independiente de Color, there was some deliberate attempt by the Garveyites in Cuba to conceal the racial element. And that comes clearly in this emphasis in the religious way, but also very, very clearly in instances in which when the organization was going to register with the government in the Registro de Asociaciones, the associations registry with the government, they would put register the organization instead of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League, they would register it as the Universal Improvement Association. So there's at least one or two instances in which sort of the word Negro gets sort of silenced or erased in order to fulfill the major goal, which is basically to at least have the organization active. But what was very, very important, even after Garvey passed away, and the Garvey movement sort of collapsed in the United States, still in Cuba, they were very, very active. One very memorable moment during my field work in Cuba was this moment where I went to interview one elderly woman in Hobabo, and I'm doing the usual introduction as a researcher, explaining her before the interview, explaining her what I'm working about. And when I mentioned the word Garvey, she immediately, I haven't taken out, my tape recorder or anything, and she immediately said, the door of Africa opened for all the Africans. And it was sort of that moment where you sort of could see the lasting impact of Garveyism in the country. And this was an Afro-Cuban woman. So it was not even one of the British Antillians, but an Afro-Cuban woman that obviously lived and shared her life in one town which had a strong a British Antillean community.
So another strategy that the Black migrants used was something that you call epistolary activism, which I think is such a lovely phrase that says so much about bureaucracy and power and the perception of power. Can you talk a little bit about how it worked and how effective you think it was?
Yeah, I think it was very, very, very effective. And basically, what you see when you go to the archives, so one of the sort of the main pieces of evidence that I was lucky to have in order to write this book, was that British West Indians or British Antillians would write, they felt entitled to the attention of the empire. They were British subjects, and they either truly and genuinely believed that or were very tactical and pragmatic about it in terms of how they could use that imperial allegiance. So they would write to the consuls in the different provinces or the vice consuls, seeking attention whenever they had trouble with the Cubans or whenever there was a salary dispute or any other issue, an incident of racism and discrimination. And generally, and this is another way of racism, generally the vice consuls would sort of disregard them completely. They would not pay attention. And what they did was that they would start to write up the bureaucratic ladder of the British Empire. So once they don't have a response from the vice consul in the provinces, they would write, some of which were actually very connected or involved or related to either the sugar companies or even the very process of blackbirding or migration between the colonies and Cuba. So once that didn't work, they would write to the British embassy in Havana. And if that didn't work, then they would start to write to different offices of the British Empire, some of them that were veterans of the First World War, the British West India Regiment, would write actually to the War Office so that the War Office could make the argument on their behalf. Others would write directly to the Colonial Office, to the Foreign Office, and even to the King, to King George himself. So they would, they felt entitled that they could do it. And that was, for me, that was just amazing. And the language they use to make their argument and put their point across in a very convincing way. So that was sort of the escalator, the bureaucratic escalator that went. And the effect it had was that once it reached a certain point in the hierarchy of the empire, either people in the Foreign Office or the Colonial Office would make an inquiry to the consuls in the island, and then the consuls would feel that they have to give an explanation. So it was a very smart and intelligent way in which I think the British Antillians put the consular officers in the spot. They would also write, there were different versions of it. They would also write to the colonial governments in Jamaica or in Dominica, or to specific lawyers or people in newspapers in the islands. But it was a way sort of to put pressure from abroad, and in that way, British consuls would feel compelled to act, and that happened in many moments because they had to provide a response. So I think it was a very smart move. I think other imperial subjects would do something similar. Would appropriate the language of the empire as it happened. I think that I was inspired by the work of William Rosebery for Mexico, but also, the work of David Sartorius on Spain and Cuba in the 19th century, brings that element as well. It was an element that was surprising, because it's not necessarily, there's an element of the historiography that wants to serve to do the heroic Black African diasporic struggle without taking into account that there were other sort of more complex and even contradictory ways that doesn't necessarily fit with the with an assertion of blackness or that was Garveyism and that was there. So this element brought more complexity to the whole picture and a history that is just massively complex.
So another one of the historiographic kind of commonplaces that you take down is the effectiveness of the 50% law.
Yeah.
So I think that most people argue that really reduced the number of immigrants in the country, but you actually argue that a lot of them left, but a lot of people stayed.
Yep.
And so that 50% law is not the kind of benchmark that we usually see it as.
Yeah. And that was probably one of the most, it tells a lot about how we think about chronology and where we put the boundaries on our study. You know, the first iteration of this book was a doctoral dissertation that stopped in the classic moment that everyone stops, which is the 1930s, either 1933 or 1938. And it was only when I sort of decided to sort of build on the book and extend it further and I looked at documents in the 1940s that I really said, you know, there's something more to say here. You know, there's something that happened after the 1930s. And that is that after 1938, you still have tens of thousands of British Caribbean migrants living in Cuba and working actively and organized in the Garvey movement or in other associations. So in a way, one of the reasons why this happened was that if the consular actions have some effect after many episodes of diplomacy, like the one after the massacre and the white papers that were published in 1924, was that the Cubans were more lenient, if you want, with the British Antilleans than with the Haitians, which had a really rough time in terms of the deportations and the treatment by the Cuban government. Not that the British Antilleans didn't have it, because my book actually proves that not only that it happened to all the black migrants, but that it was more complex than the easy argument that the British Antilleans had it easy because they had the consuls and the Haitians didn't. And of course, the work of Matt Casey, Empire's Guest Worker, is a wonderful book that deals more with the Haitian part of the equation. But certainly, there is a moment in the 1930s and 40s where you see that the Cuban government is sort of being more relaxed about leaving some of these British Antilleans just stay in their communities, particularly in places like the Cuban American Sugar Company, that as company towns, they were sort of secluded and they operated as a state within the state. And as long as they didn't bother the general Cuban population being in the Chapar and Delicias, they were okay. But at the end of the day, when things, when push comes to shove, after the 50% law in 1933 and after the massive deportations of the 1930s, you still have thousands of British Antilleans there living. And for those of us that went to Cuba and spoke with some of the descendants and so people like some of the ones that were still active in Cuban educational field, like Alden Knight and the artist field, people that you see, there is a legacy to that community. But so that's one thing. But when you see the actual numbers of the after the 1930s, you really start to raise a different set of questions. And that's probably what happened when I expanded the chronological scope of the book to the 1940s, to find out that many other things were happening and were taking place that involved not only the Cuban story in terms of how they dealt with this black presence in the island, but also a pan-Caribbean story that involved the British Caribbean colonies and how they, you know, how they dealt with the fact that they had all these British subjects living in Hispanic Caribbean context abroad. So it's certainly the story goes beyond the 1930s in very fascinating ways.
Yeah, and just to pick up on that, you do open up the 1940s, and it's a period that we don't have that much on for Cuba. And one of the things that you say, which I was startled, but which made sense to me, is that there's this desire for what you call a national utopia of whiteness. Mm-hmm. And even Ortiz participated in this. And so it really sort of brings out all of the strands of those kinds of things that get forgotten in all of the attention to the 1940 Constitution and all of that. How do you think about the role of these British West Indians in the national imaginary in the early 1950s, just on the eve of the revolution?
Mm-hmm. I guess that's a story that follows, you know, after, I mean, whoever, you know, is going to write, you know, what happens after the 1940s. But I certainly, you know, it was clear to me that as much as many of the elites and the intellectuals wanted to create this national imaginary, they couldn't escape the presence of British Antilles and Haitians and other groups. They had to deal with them. So in many ways, sort of in the 1940s, when you have sort of the making of the Constitution but still you see that struggle to trying to ignore something that is clearly there and that was going to stay. So there's an acknowledgement of the Afro-Cuban element, but there is and in that sense of blackness within the nation with, you know, limits, of course, but there is also a way in which language and culture become elements for difference. So if you put language and religion, then that would keep the British Antilles away. Of course, what happens is that they stay, they create their communities. After the revolution, many of them remain there, active and taking a role, sort of very much underground, but you could see them. I mentioned already Alden Knight, but people like Cuban Teofilo Stevenson and other people that were, you know, of renowned names that come from British Antillean heritage, then you know that presence is there. In the 1970s, there were stronger links between Jamaica and Cuba because of the Manley government in Jamaica. And so that also generated some more linkages. But still, British Antilles remain sort of on the margins. It is not until, of course, when the revolution wins, you know, Castro sort of admits, you know, and there's a speech in which he admits, you know, these are people are part of us, and he recognizes their contributions. But in many ways, during the revolution, they remain with this sort of exceptional people, you know, like Stevenson, like Alden Knight, and others. Now, they remember as island, and it's not only only recently in some of the scholarship coming out of Cuba that with people like Graciela Chalux and others have highlighted all the diversity within the Cuban nation that is not necessarily a monolithic element. So I think what I would say is that that there was a persistence of the Antillean sort of a staying power, if you want, that was going to bother whatever national project they wanted to sort of build in the 1940s, you know, whether in the voice of Mañach or Ortiz in that period. And then they remain after that, partly because they didn't want to leave. They were they had made families then, but also the British West Indies, the British West Indian government didn't want them because they were dealing with their own crisis in terms of economy and politics. So they remained there in that limbo. The revolution came, sort of they stayed living in their communities, whether that was Paragua, or whether that was Chaparra or Delicias, and remained somewhere, you know, somehow hidden. And secluded in those communities, where if you still go now, as is shown in Gloria Rolando's film My Footsteps in Baragua, you see that, you know, they remain as a community, as a very strong community. So that they are there, you know, they are there as a strong presence, even if they didn't want to be recognized at specific moments by specific people, you know, with certain national discourses.
So I've taken up lots of your time, but before we go, I want to bring it back to the UK, because you do so in the book, and then I know that you've written a little bit more about that, especially in light of the Windrush controversy, et cetera. And really, in the book, you know, I had to sort of close it and then think about it for a little bit, but you do actually critique the British colonial officers as much as the Cuban or American participants in the kind of racialization processes. And so I would love to close with you sort of thinking a little bit about how do readers think about this stuff today? How would you like readers to come away with this and put it in context of the kinds of things that we're seeing about immigration in our own lifetime?
Yeah, well, I guess that there is, one always wants to sort of, sort of in writing history, you always want to think of, you know, how your project is relevant to the contemporary moment. And of course, you know, the past is the past because there is a present, as Michel Rolf Trouillot said once. So the story basically repeats itself. If you think about, for instance, you know, again, thinking about migration context, you know, the Abby Chomsky's book on the myth, the myths of, I don't remember the name. They what's the name? The title of the book. They steal our jobs, and the 20 myths of immigration that is written from the U.S. context, but also with a sort of global scope. Many of those myths repeat itself in other sort of migration histories that we have explored in the past, and that certainly happens with the British Antilles in Cuba. So the criminalizations which we see now in the US with the president, and also in Europe, the criminalization of the migrant as damaging to the national body and the whiteness of the body, whether we think of the body of the nation, I mean, whether we think of Enoch Powell in the 1960s in Britain, or more recently with the debates of the Windrush generation after the scandal in 2018, so after the scandal broke out. So there are elements that remain the same, and in a way, without repeating the tried argument that history repeats itself, because of course it's not the case that it repeats itself in the same way, but there are elements that we can learn from, and I remember Lennox Honisher, the historian from Dominica, that, you know, he was intervening in a contemporary debate in Dominica in a television discussion. And he said, well, I have seen this box before, referring to the fact that he has seen that discussion in a previous box in the historical archives. And we have much to learn from it. So certainly there's much to learn about how Black people and people of color and people of African descent are discriminated when they are migrants, but also much to learn about how national imaginaries are the ones that, you know, specific national imaginaries of whiteness are the ones that, you know, that create the environment for that discrimination. So that's one element of it. A second element, of course, speaking about the Windrush is that the Windrush scandal is that, you know, there's a continuity here in terms of the debates about race and blackness and whiteness, and in what relates to the discussion that ensued after these people from the Windrush generation were deported and or put in detention camps. You know, that history of seeing Britain as white was there before, and it was there before in a different historical moment, but also in a different geographical context. So there's much to think in terms of sort of learning from history, but also being able to see the continuities in historical trajectories of different countries.
Well, that's a lot for everybody to think about, yeah. I think. Thank you so much. It's been really wonderful talking to you today.
No, it has been a great pleasure. It's, you know, one of those pleasurable and great occasions when one, you know, gets to speak a lot about, you know, something that one devoted so much time in doing. And so I'm really grateful for your time and the opportunity.
It's a pleasure.
Okay.